This is a recording of the Paul Tedger Conference with the July National Content Call on July 8th, 2014 at 11 a.m. Central. Excuse me, everyone. We now have our speakers in conference. Please note that participation on this call is by express written invitation from the AHA for AHA members only. Unauthorized participants and or any party that aids unauthorized participants may be subject to criminal and civil penalties under both state and federal law, including the Electronic Privacy Act. At the conclusion of today's presentation, we will open the floor for your questions. At that time, instructions will be given if you'd like to ask a question. It is now my pleasure to introduce today's first presenter, Ms. Janine Reisinger.
Thank you, David. Hi, everyone, and welcome to the July National Content Call. We're so excited to have you with us on today's call, which will focus on procedural-related catheter use. Before we begin today's presentation, just a quick reminder that today's call is a webinar, so please be sure to log into the webinar link in order to see the slides. A copy of the slides and the recording will be posted on the project website later this week. Today's presenters include Dr. David Pegues, who is the Medical Director of Healthcare Epidemiology, Infection Prevention and Control, and of the Antimicrobial Stewardship Program at the Hospital of the University of Pennsylvania. He is a professor of medicine in the Division of Infectious Diseases at the University of Pennsylvania School of Medicine. We also have Dr. Gregory Kennedy, who is a colon and rectal surgeon and associate professor of surgery and the vice chair for quality in the Department of Surgery. He has an academic interest in patient safety and effectiveness. He is the physician leader of the Clotting Prevention Group at the University of Wisconsin. Without further ado, it's my pleasure to introduce our guest speakers. David?
Thanks very much, Janine, and welcome all of you who are participating today in the National Content Call. By way of outline, Greg and I will be talking today about the use of urinary catheters in surgical practice and other procedure areas. We're going to review the appropriate indications for catheter use among surgical patients, and we're going to talk about strategies that limit the duration of urinary catheter use, particularly around the prevention and management of postoperative urinary retention. Greg's portion of the presentation is going to highlight some of the clinical pearls and pratfalls of implementing a protocol to decrease the duration of urinary catheter use in his hospital among his surgical patient population. Next slide, please. Just by way of brief review, you know that urinary tract infections are one of the most common healthcare-associated infections. A recent prevalence survey done in the United States suggested almost 13% of all healthcare-associated infections, representing almost 100,000 cases per year, are urinary tract infections, the bulk of which, about 70% or more, are associated with indwelling urinary catheters. And recent estimates suggest that about a quarter of patients who are hospitalized will have an indwelling urinary catheter at some point during their hospitalization. Most have a short duration of anywhere from 2 to 4 days, but many critically ill patients, that duration will be substantially longer. And as a result, their risk of acquiring a device-associated infection increases, and as shown below, the probability of developing bacteriuria increases with duration of catheterization, whereby at a month or 30 days, 100% of patients will have bacteria or bacteriuria associated with their indwelling urinary catheter, particularly associated with the formation of biofilms. Next slide, please. So for the first polling question, does your facility currently perform surveillance for CAUTI on surgical patients? The options are yes, no, and no, but we'll have to in January 2015. And that last option reflects the fact that as part of the CMS inpatient quality reporting program, all adult and pediatric patients in both ICUs and acute care units will be reportable in terms of quality surveillance beginning in January 2015. So please go ahead and vote. And Janine, tell us how long we need to wait, or go ahead and show us the polling results.
Sure, we still have some people actively voting, so we'll give another 10 seconds.
Sure, vote early and vote often.
All right, I'll go ahead and show the results.
Well, that's impressive. The bulk of people participating in today's call, fully 90%, are currently performing Cowdy surveillance among surgical patients, and an additional 7% will be performing it beginning in 2015. So this talk, therefore, should be particularly relevant to our audience. That's always good to know. Next slide, please. This is some recent data from the CDC's National Healthcare Surveillance Network looking at rates of catheter-assisted UTI and urinary catheter device utilization by a variety of surgical ICU and acute care types. And you can see in the blue bars that our rates of CAUTI range anywhere from 1.2 to 3.2 per 1,000 device days, and device utilization ranges from about 20 to 25% among surgical acute care units up to 75% in surgical intensive care units in major teaching hospitals. Next slide, please. The bulk of these catheters in surgical patients are placed in the pre- or perioperative period to manage interoperative and immediate postoperative urinary output in patients undergoing major surgical procedures. But there are a variety of other procedure areas where urinary catheters may be placed. These include labor and delivery among women undergoing elective or emergency section procedures, electrophysiology labs, particularly in patients with congestive heart failure who are undergoing ablation procedures for recurrent ventricular arrhythmias, in interventional radiology in a subset of patients, particularly those undergoing invasive GU procedures, and increasingly in ambulatory surgical centers as well. Next slide. If many of you have participated in previous national content calls, you'll probably be familiar with Jesner Vermettings and Sanjay Saint's nice model of the life cycle of a urinary catheter, emphasizing that at each point along the life cycle of a urinary catheter from insertion, maintenance, removal, and reinsertion, there's an opportunity for evidence-based practices to decrease the use of urinary catheters and to insert and maintain them appropriately. And I've just highlighted here that three of the four life stages, if you will, are particularly relevant to management of urinary catheters in surgical patients, focusing on unnecessary and improper placement, prompt catheter removal in the immediate post-op period, and the use of post-catheter removal protocols to decrease the need for reinsertion of catheters among patients with urinary retention. Next slide. So let's get down to the meat of the matter, so to speak. Why are urinary catheters used perioperatively? And there are really three major reasons. First and foremost of which is monitoring urine output during and after major surgical procedures. For patients with excessive intraoperative blood loss, they're an important tool to help guide intra and immediate postoperative volume resuscitation. And in a portion of patients, particularly under those undergoing selective surgical procedures or receiving certain types of regional anesthesia, they have an important role to play in preventing the risk of postoperative urinary retention. Next slide. So hearkening back to the 2009 HCPAC guidelines to prevent catheter-associated urinary tract infection, I've highlighted here in red appropriate perioperative indications for the use of indwelling urinary catheters that involve selected surgical procedures, particularly those that are involving the urologic tract or continuous GU tract for patients who are undergoing prolonged surgical procedures where there is clearly an opportunity to remove them in the immediate postoperative setting in the PACU. For those patients anticipating undergoing receipt of large volumes of infusions and or diuretics during surgery, for patients who have pre-existing urinary continence, and for those where there is need for inner and immediate postoperative monitoring of urine output. Next slide. With respect to inappropriate indications are felt to be present when catheter use is excessive in terms of duration without an appropriate indication, such as repair of a urethral or contiguous structure, or prolonged effects of epidural anesthesia, and for routine use in patients receiving epidural anesthesia or analgesia. In other words, just because you're getting an epidural for pain relief or intraoperative anesthesia is not a reason that the patient requires an indwelling urinary catheter. Next slide. let's go back more than a decade ago with the advent of SIP, the precursor of the SCIP program for surgical improvement program. This is looking at data from 2001 with almost 36,000 patients undergoing major surgical procedures. You can see an impressive overall prevalence of catheter use of 86%, and something that I think you will agree is intuitive. With catheter duration longer than 2 days, you see an early divergence at about 6 or 7 days in the risk postoperatively of developing catheter-associated urinary tract infections. And clearly, this utilization more than a decade ago, in excess of 50% of patients with catheter use for more than 2 days with an opportunity to decrease catheter use in the surgical population by early postoperative removal. Next slide, please. So, polling question two. What is your compliance with the SCIP infection 9 process measure? Less than 80%, 80 to 90, 89%, 90 to 95%, greater than 95%, and for some of you, what is SCIP infection 9? Please go ahead and vote.
We have about 15 more seconds.
Of participants today, 55% fully indicate that their compliance with SCIP infection 9 is greater than 95%. And I included the last question, what is SCIP infection 9, to indicate that, and not surprisingly, that some people don't know that this is a publicly reported process measure. So let's talk about what SCIP infection 9 is. Next slide, please. SCIP infection 9 is a CMS, or Center for Medicare Services, mandated SCIP process measure. The measure states that patients whose urinary catheters need to be removed on the first or second day after surgery. Currently, it's one of 12 of these clinical process of care measures that will have in fiscal year 15 a domain weight of 20%. Historically, in recent years, it's been given even greater weight, but the patient experience is being increasingly valued. Importantly, and I think consistent with our poll results, the current compliance rate, that's rate, not rat, is 97%, so it's nearly topped out. Many hospitals that have focused on that have achieved these high rates overall of compliance through the use of pre-printed post-operative order sets and other processes of care that limit the duration of catheter use. Important to note, there are exceptions in patient populations. Patients undergoing procedures where there may require a more prolonged duration of catheter use, like urologic or gynecologic or perineal procedures, as we've emphasized before in the appropriate use criteria. But there's also a opt-out, if you will, patients who had a physician, advanced nurse practitioner, or a physician's assistant documentation of a reason for not removing the urinary catheter. So let me show you an illustrative study that I came across recently. Next slide. This is from Emory University, and their aim in using a retrospective case control study design was to correlate compliance overall with the SCIP process of care measure, removing the urinary catheter in post-op day 1 or 2 with monthly rates of UTI among general and vascular surgical patients. And I've just included the process measure there, the exemptions, and how the CMS requires documentation. Next slide. So what did they find? I don't expect you to all be experts in linear regression, but that R is a small number, and basically showing an inverse relationship between the rate of use, TIs, and the compliance with SCIP infection 9. But there is no significant correlation. That's what that large p-value means. When you look at the figure on the right, relationship between UTI cases and exemption status, the green line shows the overall number of cases by month of catheter-associated urinary tract infections, and the sort of orange-brown line immediately below it shows essentially that all the urinary tract infections, or the vast bulk of them, were occurring in patients who were exempt from SCIP infection 9 because of physician, nurse practitioner, or physician's assistant exemption, or certain surgical procedures. The odds for developing a UTI, the highest odds were associated with patients who had this exempt status, and the author's take-home point for this study is that way too many exemptions exist for skip infection 9 to be an effective driver, reducing the overall use of urinary catheter use among all surgical patients and reducing their risk of postoperative cavities. Next slide. So let's talk about postoperative urinary retention. Clearly one of the important reasons for the use of urinary catheters in surgical practice. This isn't meant to be comprehensive, but simply to indicate that in a variety of general and special surgical procedures, the incidence of postoperative urinary tract retention, or POOR, can be quite substantial. Up to almost 85% of patients undergoing anorectal or low perineal resection surgical procedures, particularly for colorectal carcinoma. Risk factors, again, not comprehensive but not surprisingly, include perioperative, intra, and postoperative risk factors. Perioperative risk factors include some demographics like age, male gender, benign prostatic hypertrophy, previous surgery, or underlying neurologic diseases that may be associated with neurogenic bladder, and use of certain medications which increase the incidence of urinary retention. We're going to talk at some length about the role of anesthesia, or a choice of anesthesia in causing postoperative urinary retention, both in the intra as well as the postoperative period. Next slide, please. So let's get a more recent estimate of what the incidence of postoperative urinary urinary retention and the management is in a selective surgical procedure with a high prevalence of catheter use. Total joint arthroplasty. In this case series, almost 290 consecutive patients undergoing total knee or total hip arthroplasty were assessed in terms of their complications, risk factors, and management of postoperative urinary tract infection. Not surprisingly, the 73 out of 286 patients who had postoperative urinary tract infection had a 2.5 times greater risk of developing a UTI and on average had a one additional day length of stay related to their urinary retention. And I think this study was important because it showed the risk of postoperative urinary tract retention varied by the type of anesthesia being greatest for those patients receiving epidural compared to patient-controlled analgesia and lowest for patients undergoing continuous peripheral nerve block. Management patients, about a quarter of patients required only a single in-and-out straight catheterization following the use of a bladder scan. An additional 10% required two straight caths, and a number of patients, almost two-thirds, required replacement of the urinary catheter for up to 48 hours. Next slide, please. So there are useful scoring systems which can help preoperatively predict a patient's risk of developing postoperative urinary retention, and one of these risk models is the International Prostate Symptoms Score. American Urologic Association designed it a couple of decades ago, and there's seven fairly simple and straightforward questions scored on the basis of 1 to 5 in terms of the frequency, including incomplete bladder emptying, urinary frequency, intermittency, urinary urgency, weak stream straining, and nocturia, where the score is given for the number of episodes per night. And the risk of postoperative urinary retention varies depending on what the score is, with a maximum score being 35. The usefulness of this IPSS score for predicting postoperative urinary retention in patients undergoing total limb arthroplasty has been somewhat variable, however. Next slide. Here is one recent study from England of 100 consecutive male patients undergoing either total knee or total hip arthroplasty. Of these, 8 patients were excluded because they required a preoperative urinary catheter for urinary retention. Their mean age was 68 years. All of them underwent spinal anesthesia, and an additional third had a peripheral nerve block. Those with mild, moderate, or severe IPSS scores were assessed far and away. 60% had mild and IPSS scores and had a risk of short-term urinary retention and requirement for catheterization of about 25%. In contrast, those who were scored as severe, having scores anywhere from 20 to 35 on their IPSS score, had a risk of postoperative urinary retention and need for catheterization in excess of 80%. Next slide. So, if we've found that male patients, particularly those who are in their sixth or seventh decade of life with underlying benign prostatic hypertrophy and symptoms reflected in the IPSS score are at high risk of postoperative urinary retention, what can be done perioperatively to decrease that risk? And this is a study that was published recently in a Brazilian urologic journal that looked at a small but prospective randomized double-blind placebo-controlled study done at a single teaching hospital of 232 male patients undergoing elective GU or urologic surgery, and that includes variceal surgery, inguinal herniorrhaphy, or scrotal surgery. Patients were randomized to receive tamsulosin or placebo, and the drugs were given 2 hours pre and 10 hours post-surgery, and they looked at the incidence of postoperative urinary retention and found overall that those receiving tamsulosin had a 6% compared to a 23%, so a one-quarter risk of postoperative urinary retention. So there, not only are patients at high risk of postoperative urinary retention based on their IPSS score, but once you've identified high-risk patients, the tamsulosin or another alpha-blocking agent can potentially decrease the risk of urinary retention and the need for intermittent catheterization or replacing the indwelling urinary catheter. Next slide. And this was a recent systematic review from the anesthesia literature showing a large number of studies looking at the mean incidence and confidence intervals around the risk of postoperative urinary retention associated with different routes and forms of anesthesia. Overall risk associated with general anesthesia was 17%. Those who are undergoing regional blockades had similar incidence, but the highest incidence overall was associated with patients undergoing epidural anesthesia. Next slide. So, polling question number three. Do you know whether urinary catheters are routinely inserted in patients receiving epidural anesthesia at your facility? And the choices are yes, all patients, yes, but only in selected patients, never, or don't know. Please go ahead and vote.
Give us about another 10 seconds.
We're pretty evenly split between all patients, selected patients, and don't know. And if you had asked me this question a year or more ago, I would definitely have voted that I didn't know. Okay? So the important point is, and I think emphasized by the HCPCS appropriate use criteria, that just because the patient is receiving epidural anesthesia does not require the use of an intra- or post-operative indwelling urinary catheter. Next slide. So how the risk of post-operative urinary retention varies by site of epidural, by the choice of anesthetic agents or analgesic agents, as well as by the dosage. And so this is just a brief review that urinary retention occurs more commonly when the epidural is placed in the lumbar compared to the thoracic position, is more commonly associated with longer-acting local anesthetics, hydrophilic opioids that cross the blood-brain barrier more effectively, that's particularly true for morphine, opioids with high mu receptor selectivity, that includes morphine and fentanyl, epinephrine. And I think importantly in terms of working with your anesthesiologist to define a lower and a higher risk group, the higher doses of bupivacaine as a regional anesthetic is associated with urinary retention. So doses below 0.1% are associated with a lower incidence, and patients receiving this dose needn't necessarily receive an indwelling urinary catheter. Next slide. So, what about the duration of postoperative urinary catheter use? Appropriate duration for urinary catheter use for patients undergoing thoracic epidural catheters has been looked at in this randomized clinical trial looking at the risk of UTI among patients with thoracic epidurals who were scored preoperatively as having low risk of POOR, early removal versus standard care, which basically involved removing the catheter at or before 48 hours versus keeping the catheter in place until the epidural catheter was removed. They looked at outcomes including UTI rate, the frequency of intermittent catheterization, and the need for repeat catheter insertion. Overall, the urinary tract infection rate was decreased 86% among those with early removal of the catheters. The risk of intermittent catheterization was increased fourfold, but typically these patients required one or two intermittent catheterizations. Only 2.8% of patients overall required replacement of the urinary catheter for an additional 24-hour period before subsequent removal. So the take-home point is that early removal of the urinary catheter following epidural anesthesia reduces the risk of CAUTI with an acceptable rate of short-term urinary retention that can be managed in the bulk of patients by one or two intermittent catheterizations and the use of a bladder scanner. Next slide. So what about the duration of catheter use in patients undergoing anal rectal surgery? We mentioned that this is an appropriate indication for a catheter and that it's an exemption for the catheter removal skip infection 9 measure on postoperative day 2. Studies suggest that the duration of use is all over the map, anywhere from a mean of 3 to 10 days, and the incidence of POOR reported in the literature varies widely over tenfold, anywhere from 5 to 58%, and the risk of CAUTI, however, is substantial in this patient population. Overall, about 50% of patients undergoing these procedures in some series have developed symptomatic urinary tract infections. It's important to note that patients who lack risk factors for POOR, who are undergoing anal rectal surgery, in other words, they don't have preoperative dysuria, they don't have positive lymph nodes associated with rectal cancer, there is evidence to suggest early catheter removal has been used successfully to limit the duration of catheter use and the risk of CAUTI associated with excessive duration of use. Next slide. So, urinary catheter use for selected urogenital surgical procedures. What does this say? Using your urinary catheter versus not using your urinary catheter has been studied in a recently updated Cochrane Systematic Review. Using a urinary catheter is associated with a lower incidence of urinary retention. Well, that makes sense. When you have a catheter in place, you're not going to retain urine. But it also shows that the risk of developing a symptomatic urinary tract infection is increased modestly, about 35% overall, although the confidence intervals overlap one. Recatheterization is also increased among patients who use an indwelling urinary catheter versus those who don't. Another question that was assessed in this review includes comparison of short versus long-term catheter use. I think a more relevant comparison, urinary tract retention, the frequency of urinary tract infections, and the need for recatheterization were both looked at. There was no significant difference in the risk of urinary retention among patients with 1 versus 3 days of catheter use. However, the risk of urinary tract infection was substantially lower, reduced by 50% in those with short duration of use compared to 1 versus 3 days. And the risk of catheterization or recatheterization was not different. Next slide. So, What about a special population, the duration of postoperative catheter use for patients undergoing bariatric or weight reduction surgical procedures? My take-home point here is that immobility is not synonymous with immobilization. Patients who cannot be moved are different than patients who may choose not to move. The goal of early recovery in patients undergoing complex bariatric surgical procedures is to improve early postoperative mobility, and a urinary catheter in these patients is a inhibitor to getting them up and about. So the goal in patients undergoing bariatric surgical procedures is the same as other general GI or abdominal surgical procedures with a catheter should be removed by 24 at 48 hours at the latest. Next slide, please. To conclude, I've tried to summarize some of the teaching points with respect to perioperative urinary catheter management and risk of poor. Patients at low risk of urinary retention include patients undergoing outpatient surgical procedures in ambulatory surgical centers, short duration procedures, those requiring low volumes or small volumes of intravenous fluid hydration, and local anesthetics. In that patient or these patient groups, a urinary catheter should be avoided under most instances. Among patients undergoing surgical procedures that put them at higher risk in an inpatient setting, most major surgical procedures that are more prolonged, i.e., more than 2 hours or an hour and a half, or require up to or more than a liter of fluid, they can be managed with short-term catheter use with the catheter removed in less than 24 hours. For the small group of patients undergoing anorectal surgical procedures, lumbar, epidural, anesthesia, or analgesia, there may be a benefit to maintaining the urinary catheter for 48 hours with attempted early catheter removal, bladder scan, and intermittent catheterization if necessary for up to 24 to 48 hours. Next slide. And finally, polling question number 4. Do providers at your facility utilize a post-removal protocol to manage postoperative urinary retention among your surgical patients? We've talked a lot about bladder scanning. Do you have a systematic way of approaching it in your surgical patients who had their catheters removed? Please vote.
Another 20 seconds.
So 2/3 of patients and your facilities have the benefit of a post-removal protocol. In the remaining quarter to 1/3, you either don't have a protocol or are considering it, and almost everybody knows what a post-removal protocol is. Next slide. It's a recommended intervention. This is taken from the updated guideline to prevent CALI published by Society of Healthcare Epidemiology and Infectious Disease Society of America, that suggests that all hospitals should develop a protocol for management of postoperative urinary retention, including the use of a nurse-directed intermittent catheterization and the use of bladder scanners. So to have a removal protocol, you need bladder scanners. Next slide. So at our own institution, whether providers who order urinary catheters choose to select a nurse-driven protocol for catheter removal, choose to select a pre-specified condition, time, or date for catheter removal, or choose to assess on a daily basis the ongoing need for a urinary catheter. Once the catheter is removed in our patients, whether they're surgical or medical, all patients receive the benefit of a post-removal protocol with the use of intermittent bladder scanning for patients with significant urinary retention and inability to void, as assessed by the use of a bladder scanner 4 to 6 hours after catheter removal. Next slide is my conclusion. So, to finish this first part of the presentation, if the goal is to reduce procedure-related urinary catheter use, you need to limit the indications to selective procedures in patients who are at increased risk of PORE. You need to limit the duration of catheter use by using preprinted order sets or nurse-driven removal protocols, and you need to limit the risk of reinsertion by the use of the post-removal protocol with bladder scanning. So that's all fine and good. I've talked about some of the evidence supporting the use of urinary catheters and the need to remove catheters early following most major surgical procedures. Dr. Kennedy is going to talk a little bit more about the implementation science part of things and how sometimes the challenge of evidence butts up against the reality of busy clinical practice. Thank you.
Great. Well, thank you, David. That was an excellent presentation. I want to just share with the members on the call just the experience we had at the University of Wisconsin in trying to implement our own bladder protocol and decrease our clotting rates. Our basic problem, this is in 2011 we started this work, our basic problem was our clotting rates were high, our device utilization was high, and our skip infection 9 compliance was low, less than 80%. And I just say that the CAUTI rates and device utilization rates were high in both the medical and the surgical patients. So really we undertook this to hopefully reduce both CAUTI and device utilization across the hospital. Next slide, please. Our approach was to really put together a multidisciplinary team, MD team leader, RN team leader. We also had a team leader from the executive, from the C-suite. This is our vice president of quality. We invited unit nurses to participate as well as some of our clinical nurse specialists. And then, of course, our infection control specialist was invited to participate. Next slide. To begin, we, as you laid out, David, we really divided our CAUTI framework into three parts, the insertion, maintenance, and removal. We thought that to really prevent CAUTI, we'd have to focus on these three areas, but really doing it in a systematic fashion. Insertion, we felt, would require a fairly standard approach, something that would look more like our CLABSI work with systematic insertion protocols. Maintenance, not exactly clear what to do with maintenance. I think the data is somewhat lacking here. So we felt that that might not be quite the right place to start. And, of course, removal, we thought this would be a really low-lying fruit and a good starting point. So we went ahead trying to develop a protocol for removal. Next slide, please. To do this, we thought, first and foremost, we wanted to empower the unit nurses to remove urinary catheters based on specific criteria and, of course, initiate a bladder management protocol that you had been mentioning, David. I'll just note that actually this work was started in 2009 by a much smaller group, really really the executives in the hospital really started the work, put together a bladder management protocol and initiated it, and it completely flopped. The reason it flopped is there was just lack of buy-in by physicians overall. Essentially, we got an email one day that said, hey, we're starting this, and this is going to happen. And there was an uprising. For the most part, from some of the surgeons, really, we really led the charge against it. There were really no consideration of some valid concerns, specifically some of the postoperative urinary retention in our high-risk patient population. Catheter removal in patients with epidural weren't considered. So we felt learning from that early failure, we had to get physician buy-in early on. Next slide, please. To do this, we started really a pre-implementation observation period. So we collected data prospectively in January of 2012 on our general surgery ward, including patients undergoing elective operation that would require admission to the hospital. Why did we choose the surgery ward? Because this is where we were finding our most resistance was in our general surgery, from our general surgeons, of which I am one. We looked at 96 patients in the collection. 7 were excluded. They did not have an operation. And 2 of the 89 patients ultimately had a catheter-associated urinary tract infection. Next slide, please. We we found our epidural utilization that month was about 32%. And what we noticed in the epidurals is 48% of patients with an epidural experienced urinary retention when we removed their catheter early. 6.5% of those patients developed urinary tract infection, and 22% of patients, full-on 22% of patients, had to have a reinsertion of their catheter. Next slide. Our overall rate of urinary retention was around 28%, and about 11% of those patients ended up with a urinary tract infection. 40% required a catheter replacement, and 18% of patients who were reinserted, who experienced reinsertion, developed a urinary tract infection. Next slide, please. So, in short, what we ended up doing with this data is we really went back to our anesthesiologists and showed them our rate of postoperative urinary retention in the epidural population. As you pointed out, we expected that rate to be somewhere around 15 to 20%. What we found was much higher, closer to 50%. It turns out there was some error in placement. They were actually placing the epidurals a little bit low. So those rates have now dropped down to the more acceptable, around 20%. We also fed our data back to the faculty, to our surgical faculty, to relieve some of the concerns regarding postoperative urinary retention. Just from the hallway talk, the sense was that postoperative urinary retention was going to be about over 75% if we removed catheters within the first, 24 hours or earlier. What we found was more like 30%. This was early removal on everybody. So I thought that was actually not an unreasonable place to start. Next slide, please. So we implemented this early removal and management protocol, really nurse-driven removal and bladder management protocol. We defined the indications for a catheter. We put those in our electronic medical record, really requiring the providers to select the indication. There was no opt-out button here. Was no because I said so sort of selection. This was a defined indication for catheter. We documented the presence of a catheter as part of our interdisciplinary rounds, made sure that we talked about the catheter every day in those rounds, and we knew what the indication was. We implemented a full-on education of the nurses to empower them to remove the catheters. We made this mandatory training sessions for all nurses in the hospital. So this is pretty onerous, actually. We had multiple sessions a day for about a week to get all the nurses in our hospital to come through. We presented the protocol to all physician departments at various venues to garner support, grand rounds, various faculty meetings, and myself and another physician went to all of these different grand rounds or all these different venues and presented the protocol to everybody to really get buy-in. Next slide, please. What we saw over the next couple of years is our rates of device utilization, as highlighted by the blue line there on the top, really started to drop down to our current rate of around 0.22. Our CAUTI rate also went down, but not significantly. Remember, CAUTI is a funny definition of number of urinary tract infections per 1,000 days. So as our device utilization rate will drop, our CAUTI rate may actually increase by the definition. And we did see some of that early on, but that seems to have plateaued, and our CAUTI rates seem to be generally going down. You can kind of get a sense of a trend in the orange bars of perhaps going down. You see the rates in 2011 at 4.2, 3.5 in 2012, and 3.1 in 2013. Next slide, please. Where we haven't seen much improvement is in the ICU. Our rates in our ICU have stayed flat, as highlighted here by the blue bar, 58 through 60, the blue line. But our rates in our general wards have continued to go down every year. These are just raw numbers of CAUTIs in the non-ICU units in the green. You see 96 in 2011 down to 39 in 2013. Next slide, please. And our CAUTI on our surgery ward dramatically decreased, as did our device utilization. So our surgery ward here is highlighted by the blue arrow, general surgery. you can see our CAUTI rate of 1.4, and you remember that that rate was closer to 4 in 2011 when we started. So we did see some success in our CAUTI rate in our general surgery unit. Next slide, please. Skip infection 9 compliance. We had a couple of different working groups going at the same time to improve our compliance with skip. But you'll see in 2011 when we started, which is right around the December or so of 2011, our rates were less than 90%. Over time, we sent out letters to surgical staff. We initiated a best practice alert in our electronic medical record. And you can see that our compliance is now greater than 95%, hovering close to 100% on a monthly basis here in the last several months. Next slide, please. Now, our work does continue. While we started this in 2011, we feel our removal and bladder management protocols have been a modest success. We think we have a lot of work left to do. One thing we've noticed is that when talking about insertion, we're not even sure what is getting inserted as far as catheters go. When we started this work, we looked at our inventory of catheters, literally hundreds of catheters in our inventory, from silver-coated to regular catheters. Nobody knew what should be used. We've phasing out all of the silver-coated catheters just to try to save some money and put in a standard 16 French catheter on all units, so every unit will have the same kit for insertion. A urimeter will be standard to avoid breaking connection to monitor urine as needed. And other sizes and configurations will be available, but we're also implementing more of a consult service if different sizes or different types of catheters, such as a Coudé catheter, are needed. We've implemented a new tray design. The old tray we felt was somewhat cumbersome. Multiple trays, cotton balls instead of swabs. StatLock, the locking device for the catheter, wasn't included with the tray, so we found a new tray with Betadine swabs instead of the cotton balls. The StatLock's included in the tray. It's a single layer tray, and that has been implemented in use in the hospital now. We're working now on insertion protocols and really standardized insertion, using more of a CLABSI type approach with required draping and trial of observers for insertion, empowering the observers so if they see a break in sterile technique, they can even say, hello, we need to stop this and restart because of a break in sterile technique. We're hoping that that will result in even more of a decrease in our CAUTI rates. We're also implementing some better patient-level data to just assess impact of location insertion and catheters, the impact on catheters from outside hospitals, reinsertion frequency, et cetera. Next slide, please. So, in summary, what have we learned? A multidisciplinary team is critical. The size of the team can't be too cumbersome, but you really have to get the critical stakeholders, especially the most vocal naysayers. I suspect your hospitals are much like our hospital. Our surgeons tend to be our most vocal naysayers. They tend to have the biggest egos, I suppose, and think they have the most to lose in any of these types of implementation protocols. So I think embracing those naysayers and trying to get somebody on your side is really important. Part of that, we also have to show the data back. We have to collect data. We have to share it and tell people both try to allay their fears as well as share with them how they're doing as they participate in these types of protocols. I think it's important to have thick skin here. Change is hard. Conflict is inevitable. There's going to be a lot of people complaining, and again, having your champions with thick skin is going to be important. And maybe that, again, it comes down to involving your surgeons in these protocols, getting the people with the biggest egos to participate. They tend to be the hardest to rile in that case. So I think that's all I have. Next slide, please. I'd be happy to take any questions.
Great. Thank you so much, Dr. Pegues and Dr. Kennedy. Operator, would you please give the instructions for asking a question?
Absolutely. Ladies and gentlemen, at this time, the floor is open for your questions. If you would like to ask a question, you may do so now by pressing star 1 on your touch-tone phone. We'll take questions in the order they are received. If at any time you need to remove yourself from the questioning queue, press star 2. Again, to ask an audio question, please press star 1 now.
While we're waiting for our first question, this is Dave Pegues. I'd like to sort of highlight a couple of things that Dr. Kennedy just mentioned. The first seems simple, but when not attended to, maybe a substantial issue with respect to variations in care, and that's optimization and standardization of the insertion kit. And the other thing that I was really pleased to hear is the evaluation of an observer program, and this would sort of be a question for Greg. As to who the observer is, we've mandated within the last year that all urinary catheters inserted by nurses be observed by a second nurse. This really reflects the practice predominantly on the floors, and I'm just wondering about how that might be implemented in the operating room. In thinking about this presentation, I know that determining who inserted the catheter in the operating room is often an issue, and as is actually having an order for a urinary catheter when placed in the OR, because oftentimes triggers for catheter removal depend upon the presence of an order to insert the catheter in the first place. Greg, would you have any comments about that?
Oh, yeah, David, great points, all of them, actually. So as far as our observers on the floor, a nurse, a second nurse is required. That's how we've implemented that protocol. In the operating room, this was a big area for me and my partner, who's the director of surgical operations here, to really tackle. One, we tended to view the operating room as an opportunity for us to teach the medical students to put in Foley catheters, and they would often do it for the first time on a sleep patient without ever having practiced. So we eliminated that practice first and foremost. We made it so the medical students had to have some type of a simulation event where they've actually seen the catheter tray, they kind of know how to put it in, and they've had that signed off before they're ever allowed to put in a catheter on a live patient, asleep or awake.
Do they have to have a little yellow dot on their ID badge?
Yeah, exactly, something like that, yeah. The second thing then is they're then watched by the circulating nurse, not the resident or the physician, the attending surgeon, but the circulating nurse watches them. If I put in the catheter in my operating room, which I do frequently, the circulating nurse watches me as well. So that's been, we've assigned that role to the circulating nurse. If the circulator puts in the catheter, then another nurse comes in and watches her put in. So we definitely have an observer, so it's a great point. As to your point on the order in the operating room, we found the same thing. Lack of an order is pretty frequent. So the nurse has now been inserting the order at the time of insertion. So in addition to documenting that it was placed in the operating room, she puts an order for the catheter placement. So that's how we've tackled those problems. I've also encouraged my surgeons to remove catheters in the operating room. So what I didn't share with you is on our observation, about 15% of the patients had catheters removed in the operating room. These are patients who've had bariatric procedures as well as colorectal procedures, and the rates of urinary retention were no higher. Actually, they're a little bit lower, around 10%. So we've encouraged that as well.
Great. David, are there some questions from the audience?
Yes, our first question comes from Robin McElliott with the Baker Alliance Hospital.
Hi, how are you? This is a great presentation. I have two questions. When you say nurse inserts the catheter, do you mean an RN? And the second question is, what are you doing with outside catheters for patients coming in with catheters already in?
David, do you want to take that one first?
I can speak to the second question first, and then the first question second. With respect to outside catheters, we do not recommend routinely exchanging catheters or obtaining urinalyses or urine cultures on patients who come to a facility with an indwelling urinary catheter. Now, that's not particular. That's not restricted to surgical patients. That's true for all of our patients. With respect to your first question, do we require RNs to insert urinary catheters? I think generally the RN is the individual either in the operating room or in a unit on the floor who inserts a catheter, but any provider, as Greg has emphasized, ought to have demonstrated competency, and it's the competency more than the degree that matters about whether you should or shouldn't insert a urinary catheter.
Yeah.
Thank you.
I agree, David. So at UW, we don't actually use nurse means RN in our institution.
Yeah.
And as far as the outside catheters, same protocol that you just outlined applies here as well.
Yeah. What I can tell you is that we'll allow LVNs or nurse helpers to do daily peri care, but in general, they're not the ones who are inserting the urinary catheters.
Right. Thank you.
Our next question comes from Peggy Thompson from Tampa General Hospital.
Hi, thank you. Also, great presentation. I'm really enjoying it. I have two questions as well. One is for Dr. Kennedy, and that is we have a nurse-driven protocol for removal of catheters, and we also made the mistake of not involving surgeons in that. We did involve urology surgeons, but not the rest of the surgeons, so that was our mistake. And we're in the process of trying to develop the standardized orders for insertion, so I was wondering if you would share yours. The second question is for both of you, actually. Do you have a standard protocol to change Foley catheters that don't have the tamper-resistant seal on the catheter?
Yeah, I'd be happy to share our insertion order protocol with you. I can email it to you if you want to send me an email, and I'd be happy to send you all of our protocols that we've put into our electronic medical record if you'd like. That's no problem. Or put you in touch with the nurses on the team who've been involved in this from the beginning as well. Our insertion protocols our orders are very simple, though. We just made it a drop-down menu where we have to select an indication for it. So if somebody selects an appropriate indication, it's flagged. Not to say they can't put the catheter in necessarily, but they have to have a proper indication for the most part. It allows us to then go back to the provider who just says, because I said I want one, and say, well, that's not really an indication. At least provide some education. By the way, we don't see that anymore, that indication anymore. But I'd be happy to share it with you if you'd like.
Thank you. I would appreciate that.
Sure.
Peggy, your second question had to deal with the tamper-resistant seals, and I'm not sure I have the answer to that. I know that our nurses who look at on a monthly basis in all of our units process of care measures about catheter maintenance do note things like positioning of the collection bag with respect to the bladder and whether the seal is intact or not. But I don't believe that we have a written requirement or policy that prompts catheter removal when the seal is broken. I think there's a clear trade-off. The goal is to limit the number of times the seal is broken, but whether and how the patient benefits from catheter exchange or maintaining the catheter with a broken seal, I don't think it's been well defined. Greg, did you have any insight on that one? Yeah.
No, we agree. We don't have any protocol as to removing the catheters when the seal has been broken. We have found, and maybe you guys have the same issue, our seals get broken because of people ordering to flush the catheters for some unclear reason to make sure the catheter isn't clogged. So we've tried to limit that, at least this mandatory flushing of the catheters, so we don't break the seals. But we don't require the catheter be changed once the seal has been broken.
Great. Thank you very much.
Mm-hmm.
At this time, we have no other questioners in the queue.
Great. Great, thank you. Well, this is at the top of the hour now, so if anyone has any other questions that you have for our speakers, you can always email those to onthecuffstophai@aha.org, and we'll make sure that they get to the speakers for answer. Just want to have a quick reminder about our next national content webinar, which will be occurring in August. The topic will be leveraging culture change to reduce urinary catheter use, and the presenter is Linda Green. So I want to thank everyone for your participation today, and especially thank our presenters, Dr. David Pekes and Dr. Gregory Kennedy, for a wonderful presentation. Please remember to fill out the evaluation link that was posted on the left. And then everyone, please have a happy and a wonderful day. Thank you so much.
Ladies and gentlemen, that concludes our presentation today. You may disconnect your phone lines and log off your webinars and have a wonderful afternoon.